This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And that is to try and acquire some kind of understanding as to why and how Adam HaRishon, in all his greatness, Adam HaRishon had the purest of intellect that was ever created, the purest spirit that has ever been, the greatest tzaddik that has ever been, certainly at that moment, what it was that brought him to transgress the one single mitzvah which the Ribbono Shel Olam gave him. One thing that God asked of him, and that he's unable to keep. And there are two approaches here that we're going to take in the parasha. There's the Rambam and there's Rashi. And it's from Rashi that we're going to try and get some kind of insight into this particular question. The parasha of the snake is preceded by a pasuk whose place doesn't seem to be right there. It says, Vayiyu shnehem arumim, ha'odom v'ishto, and the two of them were naked, Adam and his wife, v'lo yisboishoshu, and they were not embarrassed, they were not ashamed. And then it goes on with the story of the snake, comes to Chava, etc., etc. And Midrash asks, Rashi brings, why does it bring the story back after the statement that Adam and Chava were both naked? And Rashi brings the Midrash that the snake saw that they were naked, and he saw them being intimate in front of everybody. And the snake had a desire for Chava. Whatever that means, we don't understand the deep meanings of what the snake was. There are some of the Mephoshim that take the snake allegorically, and their proof is simply that how could the snake have spoken? It wasn't one of the punishments of the snake that he should lose his power of speech, and yet we know that snakes today don't speak. And therefore some want to say that it's an image, others say it can't be an image, it's clearly literal, but the speaking was an image, and all sorts of meanings are given to it which aren't really relevant to our understanding of the parasha. The snake is the Yetzer Hara. Whether it was a real snake that actually talked those words, which according to many of the Mephoshim it certainly was, and that was the power of the Yetzer Hara, or whether it was the power of the Yetzer Hara embodied in the snake, or whether it was the a kind of nevuah, almost a kind of sort of prophecy that went on there between Chava and the snake, which didn't really exist. It's difficult to know, and it doesn't really matter. This is the understanding of the nature and the motivation of the first sin. But in another Rashi, there's perhaps another understanding as to why this pasuk comes in this particular place, that Adam and Chava were both naked and they were not embarrassed. Rashi says, "V'lo yisboishashu, and they were not embarrassed, shelo hayu yodim derech tznius, because they did not know the way of tznius, they did not know the way of modesty." Rashi has a kasha, a very strong question. How could Adam and Chava be walking around naked? Even ordinary people don't do that kind of thing, or didn't used to do it in those days. What got into them? Says Rashi, they didn't know about tznius. But they knew the whole Torah, they knew about everything, but tznius they didn't know about. The laws of modesty, they didn't know the concept of modesty. Derech tznius, the conduct of modesty, they did not know. Lahavchin ben tov l'ra, strange words in Rashi, to discern between good and bad. What's that got to do with it? What's tznius got to do with discerning between good and bad? Asked Rashi, even though God gave him the wisdom to give each animal its correct name, he was able to term and define correctly every single animal that there was. So one would think if he had such knowledge, he would certainly know all about tznius and about tov hara. No, says Rashi, lo nosom bo yetzer hara ad ochlu min ha'etz. He did not have a yetzer hara until he ate from the tree. But nichnas bo yetzer hara, and then the yetzer hara came into him. The Yodama ben Tov Lara, and then he knew what was the difference between good and bad. That's what Rashi says, but we're going to understand that Rashi before we finish off. But one thing we do seem to see is an indication that in here lies the introduction to the whole parasha. they were not able to discern between good and bad. How do we know that? Because they walked around naked without tznius. So we don't understand yet what the connection is between tznius and between tov v'ra. This we're all going to have to examine in a few minutes' time. But we do see this, that there's an introduction here, that there was a certain naivety in Adam and Chava. Despite their tremendous wisdom and purity, there was an area of human knowledge and experience of which they were naive. That is the area of tznius, which Rashi defines in some difficult way to understand, la'abchin ben tevera, to discern between good and bad. Later on, when the snake persuades Chava, it says, v'tere ho isho, ki tov ho eitz l'maychol, v'chitavu hu le'inayim, v'nechmad ho eitz l'haskil. And the woman saw that the tree was good to eat, and that it was a pleasure for the eyes, a delight for the eyes. And was good for one's intelligence. And she took from its fruit and she ate. And she gave also to her wife with him, with her, to her husband with her, and he ate too. The Rambam asks a very important question in the whole parasha, in the second perek of the first chelek of the Moreh Nevuchim. And he says, it's very strange, it would appear, that there was something that they did not know before the sin, which they learned after the sin. That there was an area of human knowledge which they did not have before the chet, which they acquired after the chet. And it comes out basically that a chet is niska, that a sinner gets paid, he gets rewarded. He's better off having sinned. That's the Rambam's kasha. He says he was asked the question. And his answer is very classical and very important in the understanding of most of the Rishonim on this parsha. Firstly, he says, "Haseichel asher ishpia haborei al ha'odom." The seichel, the intellect, which the Ribbono shel Olam gave to Adam before the sin, "Vehu shleimusoi ha'achrei asher higia ha'odom." That is the ultimate perfection that ever got to a human being. That intellect which Adam HaRishon had before the sin was the ultimate in excellence and in perfection in human intellect. Kodem Marusri, before he rebelled. And that's what it means when it says he's made Betzelim Elohim Uvid Musoi, in the image of God and in his likeness. Uve Seichel Yavdil Ha'odom Bein Ha'emes V'Hashekeh. What is seichel for? What does one use seichel? For what does one use intellect, says the Rambam? To discern between truth and false. Emes and sheker. That's what we need seichel for. Then there hoyo nimtza ba'ashlei musayot musa. And this existed in Adam HaRishon to the ultimate. The ability to discern between emes and sheker existed in Adam HaRishon to the absolute. Omnam, however, hamegune v'hanoe. The concept of what is pleasant and unpleasant, that is not an intellectual concept, says the Rambam. That's a, he calls it mefusomis, and it's difficult to know how to translate that. Mefusomis literally means the well-known things. You don't need to be an intellect to know what's pleasant and what isn't pleasant. Even an animal knows that. But in that area which is mefusam, which everybody knows, he didn't have any knowledge at all. Because you won't say, if I say to you that the world is round, you won't say to me, that's nice. You won't say that's attractive. You won't say that's pleasant. You'll say that's true. If I say the world is flat, you won't say that's unpleasant, you'll say that's untrue. That's an intellectual concept which is subject to the laws of truth and falsehood, not to the law of pleasantness and unpleasantness. And with his intellect, Adam knew truth from falsehood. And this is in all intellectual matters. In any abstract concept, Adam HaRishon could distinguish between emes and sheker. And
And it's all this which says that he's that the chasreya me'at me'elukim, where David HaMelech says, and he was a little bit less than God himself. However, loy hoyo loy koyach liyishtamish b'mufusomus b'shum ponim, loy lahasigam. He did not have the ability to utilize the mufusomus, alright, to utilize that which is attractive and unattractive, that which is nice and not nice, that which is pleasant and unpleasant. He didn't know the concept of pleasant and unpleasant, because that's not intellectual. Although Marishan was an ultimate of an intellectual being, there was virtually nothing else to him. His body was totally subject to his spirit and to his mind. And therefore, while he was brilliant in the knowledge of truth and false, he was, so to say, inadequate in the area of attractive and unattractive, pleasant and unpleasant. Ad sha'afinu ha'goli shebemefusomus, bignus, to the point where even the ultimate of unattractive things, in terms of the kind of thing one would do in public, v'hu gilei erva, for example, a sexual relationship, lo ha'yoze megune etzloi v'lo hisig bignus, so he couldn't perceive and understand anything ugly about it. There's nothing the same as he eats and he sleeps and he uses his hands and his legs, so he uses his sexual organs. There was absolutely no understanding that there could be anything ugly in that at all, that there could be anything unattractive in that at all. Let's stop there for a moment. And is that because of his greatness or because of his baseness? Does that mean that there was something lacking in Odom HaRishon? We see the introduction of a concept here in the Rambam, that just as you can't have your glass filled with air and with water, as you put more water in it, so the air goes out, and as you put more air in it, so the water goes out, so you can't be brilliant in the abstract and in the... I'm looking for a good word for these mefusomus. Can anybody think of a good word for this? The earthly. Not quite. The well-known is the literal translation, but it's not the... It's those things that sorry? No, it doesn't mean that. The earthly may be the closest. That the more brilliant you are in the abstract, the less appreciation you have of the earthy. Of the is carnal possibly a good word for it? Not necessarily base. Carnal doesn't mean only sexual, does it? It means all forms of hedonistic pleasure, doesn't it? Don't we have any English scholars here? I think carnal is all forms of material pleasure. The more one has an appreciation of emes and sheker, the less is one's appreciation of the carnal. And therefore, since he was a person whose understanding of emes and sheker, of abstract concept, of truth and falsehood, was to the ultimate, but the chasreyu mi'atme elukim, he was just a little bit less than the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. If you take that as the two extremes, take God himself. So of course by God there is no physical. It's not shaykh at all. It doesn't exist at all. Physical pleasure is attractive, unattractive, but the concept doesn't exist. And the more you come away from the Ribbono Shel Olam, the more important those things become and the less important the intellect becomes. The closer you are to that, the more important is the intellect and the spirit, and the less important are the carnal things. Odom HaRishon was the Tzachasreyu Mi'at Me'elukim, he was just a little bit less than the Ribbono Shel Olam. So he was the ultimate of clarity in matters of emes and sheker, in matters of the intellect, of truth and in falsehood, and because of that very greatness, he was completely beyond understanding anything in the area of pleasant and unpleasant, attractive and unattractive, in the carnal pleasures. B'chasher moro v'noto el ta'avisov hadinunis v'hanois hushu v'gashmius, and when he tilted and showed a slight interest in the physical pleasures of his senses, Kemoshe Omar, as the pasuk says, Ki toiv ha'etz lemaachal v'chitay v'hu le'inayim, she notices, Chava notices that the tree is good for the eyes and that it looks nice. That's all. That's all she notices at first. That was enough. Nane, he was answered. Immediately that happened, his perfection of intellectual clarity in terms of emes and sheker deteriorated a little bit. So the procedure, according to the Rambam, was that at one stage he was completely unable to understand anything of the carnal pleasures of life, until the Isha noticed that the tree was nice. She just noticed something about it separate from its concept. The concept is the concept. It's an issue, there's a tzibur, there's an instruction from the Ribbono Shel Olam, don't touch it. That's the intellectual relationship to the tree. That's the conceptual relationship to the tree. For the first time, she notices something in addition to that. Good, you can't and you mustn't and all the rest of it, but ki tovo itz l'machal, b'chi tovo hu le'inoyim. She starts noticing that it is attractive, it does look good. So there's a touch of understanding for the first time of something looking attractive outside of the framework of the intellect. At that point, the clarity of the intellect starts diminishing. And because of that, he was rebellious in the mitzvah which was given to him because of his superiority of intellect. Had he been on this level at the very beginning, the Ribbono Shel Olam wouldn't have given him the mitzvah to start with. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave him the mitzvah because he was on the level where he could handle that mitzvah, where he could live a life totally void of any attractiveness to the carnal pleasures of life, to the material, physical pleasures of life. And here he's moved to the slightest, he's shown the slightest bit of interest, or in this case, Chava, has shown the slightest bit of interest in the attractiveness of the fruit, and immediately there's a deterioration in the Haskola, in his ability to understand and to perceive the clarity and the absolute precision of Emes and Sheker. And then he rebels. And he acquired understanding in the carnal areas. Venishka behis gamus behis nois, and he becomes immersed, he becomes involved in matters of pleasant and unpleasant. Va'az yodo shir mashi overdloy, and then he understood what he lost. As soon as one is involved in the world of pleasure, as soon as one is involved in that which is pleasurable and that which is unpleasurable, rather than that which is true and that which is false, one begins to realize that one has lost the art of discerning truth from falsehood. You can't discern truth from falsehood when you're still subjected to basic pulls and to basic drives and strivings. You can't. The Yetzer Hara, the powers, the physical powers of the human being are too strong, and one is naturally attracted to those areas, and that overpowers the mind. You can teach a child that eating sweets is bad, that it's going to wreck their teeth, then it's going to wreck their stomach, then it's going to do all sorts of terrible things. And the child, it's not difficult to teach that to the child. And you can show the child pictures of people who've got broken teeth, and you can take the child to the dentist and hear the drill. You can do all sorts of things to make the child understand that sweets are bad. All that works until the child tastes the first sweet. Then he thinks you're a liar. Sweets are jolly nice. What does business sweets are bad? How bad can they be if they taste like that? That, in a very oversimplified form, was the Eitz HaDaas. It's to understand. It looks very nice, and it tastes very nice, and it is very nice, but it's awesome. And as long as one can live where all that concerns one, and all that is the factor in one's judgments, is that which is emes and that which is sheker, it's fine. But the moment one has shown an interest in that which is pleasant, one becomes distorted already in that which is good and that which is bad. And so you'll find the child, when the child's intellect develops, doesn't say, yes, I know it's bad, but still I'll eat it. The child usually says, yeah, it's bad, but as long as you have it in moderation, it's alright. And he starts twisting the intellect to fit the mefusamus, to fit the attractive. Now that's how the Rambam learns that posuk, that batere ha'isho ki tovo etz l'maychol, was a tendency, was already a certain interest in the world of attractiveness, in the world of pleasure. Which is difficult according to Rashi, because Rashi has said that at that stage he had no Yetzer Hara at all, he had no interest in the world of pleasure until after the eating. So that means until the moment he ate, he wasn't attracted to anything but emes and sheker. So how does Rashi learn Batero Ha'isho Ki Toivo Itz L'maycho? Rashi says, Ki Toivo Itz Liyos Keilokim. It's not that she saw that the tree would be tasty. The Rambam learns it that way, and the Sipurnu learns it that way, and the Rambam learns it that way. Rashi learns it differently. She saw that the tree would be good for her godliness. She would become more godly if she ate from the tree. That's what the snake told her. And in a sense, the snake was right. The Gemara says the snake is one of the people who caused mischief but was talking the truth. it gave Odom Arishim Bechirot, just that he couldn't live with it, it was just too much. But she perceived that there was a certain elevation she could achieve by eating from the tree. Ki tov ha'etz li'yos ke'elokim, this is the intellectual, conceptual thing she's going through. It's not an attractiveness to the sight of the tree, or to the tastiness of the tree. It's to the intellectual qualities of the tree. And that it's a delight for the eyes, as the snake said to her, says Rashi, and your eyes will become opened. What does that mean? Doesn't mean that it's the pleasure to look at it because it looks juicy. It's the that means it will make the eyes open, the eyes will see things they've never seen before. The Nechmad Lahaskil, you will come to know Toivara. The snake teaches the woman, according to Rashi, that there are certain advantages in eating the fruit. You will develop desire. You will develop chendo and taivo. These are things which you will be able to achieve. Toiv v'ra, the Rambam says, good and bad are words that are used not in conjunction with truth and falsehood. When the Torah uses the word toiv v'ra, it's not talking about absolute good and absolute bad. It's talking about pleasant and unpleasant. So if somebody is eating some food and he says this is good, he doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy. If he says it's good, it means it tastes good. If he means it's bad, it means it tastes bad. That's toiv v'ra. So when the Torah talks about the Eitz Hadas toiv v'ra, it's the tree which imparts the knowledge of that which is tasty and that which is not tasty, that which is attractive and that which is not attractive. And the snake persuades her intellectually that she can achieve more spiritually if she has passions, if she has an attraction to things. If she wants, the snake says, what kind of a being are you? You're like the sun and the moon that just go round and round and round. They have no desire to do anything else. They have no yetzahara. So what kind of sky do you think they get? Imagine if you had passions. Imagine what it would be then. Imagine if you craved for things. And you overcame those passions, and you overcame those cravings. Imagine what it would be. Imagine the stature you could develop. And she realizes that ki toiv ha'etz li'yos ke'elokim, that the tree will impart to her godly powers, will make her more godly than before. And on that basis, she decides to go ahead. That's how Rashi learns it differently to the Rambam. So now we have the question. Why didn't she see through the snake? We're told in the Rashi that we first learned that the snake had ulterior motives. The snake wanted to get them into trouble. He was jealous of them. He had a taiva for them, whatever that means. Why didn't Chava realize that the snake was trying to get her into mischief? That's all. Why did she believe him? Here, the way Rashi learns it, the Chava, Eve, took the snake as her Rebbe. She saw Vateira Isha ki Toiva is Namaichal. Liyuhu is Kelekim, just as the snake says. Ki Yodea Elekim, ki Beyomachal Chemimene, Venifbichu Enechim, Vihi Yisim Kelekim. The snake says, you will become like God. Chava's Mekabel. She accepts that. Vihi Taibel Lernaim, Kamoishe Omar Lo, as he said to her. Venifbichu Enechim, she's accepted his learning, his teaching. The Nechmad Laskil Kamoi Sheomar Lo, as he said to her, Yede Tevero. So the snake has accepted the Chava has accepted the snake. She sat at his feet and she accepted the Torah from him. Why did she do such a thing? Doesn't she realize that he's out for his own good? If we combine the first part of the Rambam with the Rashi that we learnt, we begin to understand the concept. The Rambam says Toiv v'ra, the Sifurna says the same, does not mean good and bad. Toiv v'ra means attractive and unattractive, pleasant and unpleasant. The Sifurna says it when we were introduced first to the Eitz Hadas Toiv v'ra. We did the Sifurna, I think, 2 years ago. Toiv v'ra, says the Sifurna, Livchoir ha'orev afal pi shiyazik. This tree is the tree of good and bad, which enables one, which motivates one or drives one to choose the pleasant although it is harmful, the limois habilti orev apapi shiyoyil, and to reject the unattractive even though it's useful, even though it's good. That's the Eitz HaDa'as Tovah Ra. The Eitz HaDa'as Tovah Ra puts into a person the ability to choose pleasant over good, and to reject something which is unpleasant even though it's good. Says Rashi, why did they wander around naked? Shaloi hoyu yoidim derech tznius lahavchin bein tov l'ra. So now let's understand the words tov l'ra. They did not know the conduct of tznius, of modesty, to discern between pleasant and unpleasant. What's modesty going to do with pleasant and unpleasant? Once one understands the existence of pleasant and unpleasant, and once one understands the human failing subsequent to the chet, that we might sometimes choose to do that which is pleasant, even though it's not necessarily good, and that sometimes our biggest driving force, as the psychologists tell us, is pleasantness, not holiness. The natural thing for people to do is that which is pleasant. There is nothing more embarrassing than that to a sensitive human being. For a human being to discover that sometimes he does what he wants is the most terrible shock for a spiritual being. For an animal, it's a big discovery. I can do what I want. For a baby, for an adolescent, it's a big discovery. I can do what I want. But for a spiritual human being, it's the biggest disappointment in his spiritual life. That sometimes, not I can do what I want, that I can do what I want, that's like a discovery. That I do sometimes do what I want is the biggest disappointment of his life. Because to do what I want means I'm operating on exactly the same level as my pet cat or my pet dog or my pet monkey. They all do what they want. So what am I different? That acknowledgement of the fact that sometimes I do what I want is the most terrible disappointment, the most terrible spiritual come down. That I sometimes will do what I want, irrespective of whether it's good or bad. And yet it's a fact. It's very difficult for a human being to rid himself of that totally. To be completely unattracted by that which is pleasant. And completely attracted to that which is good, even if it's unpleasant. It's not natural for a human being. It requires tremendous koiches. The saving grace of being able one day to get there is at least to feel embarrassed about it. If the human being doesn't feel embarrassed about it, if you hear a human being saying, I do what I want in this place, then you better run a mile. That's a dangerous fellow. That's a person without a conscience. That's a person without any morality whatever. He's not embarrassed even by the fact that he does what he wants. It's a person without sinews. It's a person without modesty. A person without modesty acknowledges sometimes he does what he wants and he feels terribly embarrassed about it. And he would rather that other people didn't know it. And he covers it up. That's sinews. And that's why that part of the body which is most subject to the laws of sinews is that part of the body which most often leads people astray in doing what they want rather than in doing what is right, and where the consequences are sometimes most serious. There there's tznius. In fact, in all the bodily areas there's tznius, because what is the source? Originally Adam was a body, it was true, he had a goof, but that body was totally dominated by his mind and spirit. It had no will of its own, that body of his, absolutely no will of its own. That he had only one will, and that was the will of his mind, the will of what was right and what was wrong. There was no other cheshba. After the eating from the tree, there come two wills in the human being. The body wants what is pleasant. The mind wants what is good. And so we cover the body up. We're embarrassed about it. What's it to be embarrassed about? The nudists say. What's it to be embarrassed about the body? God made it. It's pure. It's lovely. It's actually before the chet, it was pure and lovely. It's not pure and lovely anymore because it is there that we are most inclined to do things which are pleasant, even when they're wrong. And that at least what is expected of a human being. Good, you're a human being after all, so that's how it is. You're a consequence of this chet, you're a consequence of the sin, and therefore every human being has to contend with this constant conflict and battle where his body pulls him in a way to do things which are wrong because they're pleasant. The least we can do is cover it up. At least pretend that we don't go that way. A person is not even willing to pretend that. who feels no embarrassment whatever in the fact that he sometimes does what he wants. That's a grober individual that one has to keep one's distance from. The concept of expedience is introduced here. Up till then, Odom didn't know what it was to be expedient, to do something because it suits me. That heshbon, that calculation just never came into his mind. It couldn't be. The concept of doing because it suits me, who am I? I'll do that which is right. At this point, expedience comes in. Now we have a magnificent example of a confrontation between expedience and naivety. The snake, the nachash, is kuli yetzahor. He only does what suits him. He has no sense of conscience. He doesn't do what's right and what's wrong. He's not interested in what's right and what's wrong. He's only interested in what's expedient, what is pleasant, what is nice, what will bring immediate pleasure. That's all. And you have Chava, who has no knowledge of expedience at all. She doesn't know it exists. Let's look at the Rashi again. Why were they walking around naked and unashamed? Because they didn't know tznius. Tznius is a consequence of the existence of the pleasure drive. If I never want to do that which is pleasure, then there's no difference between the sexual organs or the hand or the mouth or anything else. There's no difference. They're all dedicated to do that which the Ribbono Shel Olam commands. But once I understand that there are drives within the human being, and Freud had something when he said that one of those drives is expressed in the sexual area. That's part of the koyach, where one is attracted to do things which are not right. Why does one do them? Because they're nice. That's why one does them. At that stage, there was no such concept. Lahavchin ben tov l'ra, to notice any difference between pleasant and unpleasant. The concepts pleasant and unpleasant didn't exist in the vocabulary of Adam and Chava at that point. B'apapishinus nishma b'roi das likra shemos. And even though they were given the knowledge to call names, that was an intellectual knowledge. They didn't have the Yetzirah until they ate from the tree and the Yetzirah came into them, and then they started finding that in addition to calculations of what is good and what is bad, there were also calculations of what is pleasant and what is unpleasant. It was a new world to them. And now the snake comes along and starts telling her the whole story. That really the Ribbono Shel Olam, it's not because you're going to die if you eat from it. The Ribbono Shel Olam just doesn't want you to become as powerful as he. You, Chava, are potentially very great. That's the way to any woman's heart, is through flattery. Do you know what you are, Chava? You don't even know your own koiches. Do you realize that the Ribbono Shel Olam knows that you're one step away from him? And all you need to do is to eat from that tree and you'll become godly already. You'll be able to create worlds, you'll be able to do whatever you want, there will be no end to your possible achievements. The emotion doesn't want that. So he can't tell you that because he knows that you're such a good lady and that you want to progress. So obviously you're going to eat from the tree if he tells you that's the reason not to. So he terrifies you. And he tells you the reason is that you mustn't, you'll die if you eat from it. And come, I'll prove to you, you'll die if you touch it. And he touches the tree and he pushes her against the tree. So see, nothing happens. What goes through her mind? She takes the Nachash's argument at face value. Let's analyze it. Let's see if it's true or if it's false. That's all. It's either emes or sheker. If it's emes, it must be followed. If it's sheker, it must be rejected. Maybe it's mischief. She doesn't know the word. Never heard of mischief. Maybe it's malicious. What's malicious? She doesn't know about those. The possibility that the snake has contrived a vicious argument for his own ends doesn't enter her mind as a possibility. Therefore, the snake is either telling the truth or he's telling a lie. And she analyzes it. And each step of the way makes sense. And the final thing that convinces her is when she touches the tree and nothing happens. That proves that what the snake is saying is right. No, if that's what it is, then she works out. But it's all the big disoyan really. The Ribbono Shel Olam wants to see how ambitious she really is to become more godly. That's really what it's all about. And it's min hashamayim that this wonderful snake met her. Surely God wouldn't have sent the snake if it wasn't to convey a message to her, like we learned in the Vilna Gaon today, that the Yetzer Hara always gets you on mitzvahs. The snake isn't trying to get her to do something wrong. He knows he'll never get her to do anything wrong. The snake is trying to get her to do even more mitzvahs than God wants you to do. God didn't eat from the tree because he doesn't want you to get too holy. But you, Chava, you do want to get more holy than you are. I know you. And it all makes sense. And so she goes ahead. What we have here is a situation of a person who's naive in one area of life. The one area of life that she has to be naive in because she has no Yetzirah. She doesn't know what it is to be attracted to something because it's nice, because it's pleasant. She knows only emes and sheker. And if she can't find the sheker in the snake's words, it must be emes. And if it's emes, it must be followed. Let's examine how would Chava have related to the snake had he come to her, so to say, imagine twisting the story around a little bit, and imagine she first ate from the tree and then the snake came. How would she look at him then? What's the first thing she would have said? 1 minute, snake. What's in it for you? That's the first thing. To which the snake would have answered, don't be cynical. Can't two people have an intellectual discussion on a matter of Torah? Must there be something in it for me? To which she would have answered, yes, I know you. Must be something in it for you. Now, what do you want to say? And the snake will go over the whole story. And she'll say to herself, very simply, something in this, something's not clicking here. Something's not right. He's put a very good argument for me, but I know one thing. The way he's put the argument, there's nothing in it for him. If he's right, that I'm still going to become even greater, and the gap between him, the snake, and me is going to be even bigger, what does he want me to do this for? And she will realize that it just struck me, it doesn't go together. I can't pick out where it's wrong, it all seems right, but I know it can't be. There's a contradiction between his motivations and between what he's saying. Can't be. He's a politician. And politicians don't come along with suggestions of increased godliness. That's not the kind of thing they normally recommend. So there's something in it. There's something in it that I haven't caught yet. I'd better keep away from this man. That's what she would have said. She would have run for her life, and she would have got hold of Odom, and she would have told the story to Odom, and Odom would have said, "Sure, he pushed you against the tree, and you didn't die. I told you that you would die about being if you were pushed against the tree, but that I told you that just to keep you away. That wasn't the tzivui." Simply was that you'll die if you eat from the tree. Oh, she'll say, now I understand the mischief of the man. Now I know who he is. And the whole thing wouldn't have happened. Where did it go wrong? It went wrong because at that stage she treats a politician like a Talmid Chochem. It's equally dangerous to treat a Talmid Chochem, I suppose, as a politician. But to treat a politician like a Talmid Chochem with naive, open eyes, a wicked so-and-so, where everything he does is for self-interest. There's no step of the way that he would do anything for self-interest. And you weighing it up in terms of emes and sheker, he'll make mincemeat of you. As brilliant as you are, this is the second lesson we've had this Shabbos. Last night we learned that as brilliant as you are and as pure as you are, if you spoil it, you can't appreciate it. And today we're learning that as brilliant as you are, because nobody has been as brilliant as these two people, nobody has been as high a stature in intellect and spirit as these two people, and yet the miserable political snake makes mincemeat of them and destroys them. For one reason only. They weren't able, because of their brilliance and because of their tzidkus and because of the absolute totality of their commitment to the muskolos, as the Rambam says, that it was beyond them to conceive of the fact that he might be a politician. And then you're finished. Relate to a politician without understanding what's at the bottom of it, you don't stand a chance at all. It's often been mentioned that South African people are very naive. And there's probably truth in it. That they get taken for rides very easily, particularly in the area of Yiddishkeit. I think it's not only in the area of Yiddishkeit. I think it's very possibly in business too that happens, particularly in the areas of international trade. But in Yiddishkeit too, they get taken for rides. They get sold things which are nonsensical. How does it happen? Maybe it's part of a godless. Maybe it's the fact that they come from good Lithuanian stock where there was nothing but learning and politics didn't exist. In the Torah world of Lithuania, there was no such thing as politics. It didn't exist. There was a little bit of Jewish politics outside the Torah world, but the Lithuanians were never good at that. There were other nations, other Jewish nations that were better politicians than the Lithuanians. The Lithuanians were Talmudic people. They weren't good politicians. And in Torah itself, there was never ever such a uh, such a cheshbon. I mentioned to some people on Thursday night when we were talking after the dinner that I had the opportunity some years ago of visiting within a very short period of one another two Gedolei Israel. One was a Litvisher and one was from another group. And I was asked afterwards what was the difference between them. Both extremely wise, both very steeped in learning, Yomim V'Laila, day and night, involved only in learning, and yet there was a certain basic inherent difference in the experience. Both, it was a pleasure to speak to them, there was tzidkus in them, there was chesed in them, it was incredible in both areas, but yet there was some major difference. And it took a while until I was able to define it, and then I found that he had defined it in exactly the same way. In the one case, in the things that I discussed with the one Gadol B'Yisroel, there was no cheshbon but halacha and Torah. There was no other calculation. His mind wasn't considering anything else but that which is right. In the other ones, there were other calculations as well. There were political calculations himself, not for himself, but general political considerations. He saw the world in a different way. One needs among Gadol Yisroel, one probably needs both things, but the Litvish Gadolim have always been like that. The Litvish Gadol Yisroel, our kind of Gadolim, have always been the kind of people where there is just absolutely no other cheshbon. That's why they've always been poor, and that's why they haven't had big followings, and they don't operate, but they never built big institutions. One sees, for example, in Eretz Yisroel today, in the Hasidic world, for example, who are better politicians, and I don't say that derogatively, because they've achieved a great deal through their through their political awareness. But one finds Bells, Geir, Hasidic organizations that have built up cities, literally cities. Litvisha, nothing, little yeshiva here, little yeshiva there. Great, great people, but no massive organizations. Why not? It's a little bit like this. There's a certain tamimus, there's a certain naivety, which I don't know if it's good or it's bad, but it's there. It's a certain purity of being. Adam and Chava were incapable of calculating the political motivation of the Nachash, and in that they fell. They only analyzed his words. You can't analyze the words of a politician on the basis of, is it MS or is it Sheker? Of course it's MS. What politician is going to tell lies? He'll end up in jail if he tells lies. Politicians don't tell lies, they tell the truth. And they kill you with the truth, because they know just how much of the truth to tell and how much of it not to tell, and when to tell and when not to tell, and to who to tell and under what circumstances to tell. That's the brilliance. And if one analyzes only the facts, it can all look very kosher and it can all look very good, until you say to yourself, but I don't understand one thing. I know how that man works. He doesn't move if there's not something in it for him. And in all this that he's told me, which is all very MS, there's nothing in it for him. Therefore, I need to be a little bit cynical, and I need to question a little bit further to find out what's behind it. What is the motivation? Tznius is the acknowledgement of the fact that now we live a double life. One cannot say, but who wants to be cynical? Because any human being who goes around with that attitude and says to himself, oh, do I want to be so cynical? Do I want to go suspecting that everybody's got other motivations and ulterior motives? What kind of life is that? I just believe everybody's honest and everybody's straight. But if one does that, apart from the fact that one's going to land in a lot of trouble with other people, one's also going to land in a lot of trouble with one's own Yetzer Hara, because that means you don't know yourself. A person who says, I trust everybody, that means he trusts himself as well. And you can't trust yourself, says the Mishnah, Ad Yoyim Moyscho, until the day you die. Because until the day you die, there's a Yetzer Hara operating inside you, and there are all sorts of other calculations, and you never know who wins a particular debate. A man who is completely trusting and completely naive, it was all right for Adam and Chava to be completely naive, because they had no Yetzer Hara. But since that time, we all have Yetzer Haras. And if a man comes along with total naivety, how can you suspect him of such things? How can you suspect he's a politician? Who says there must be something in it for him? Why can't he just be saying the truth? Oh, you know that such a person is not only subject to all sorts of external manipulations, but you know that such a person is, his whole mind is in the hands of his Yetzer. He doesn't have the ability, he doesn't see the cynicism of himself. He doesn't see that he himself has other cheshbonos. He thinks he's an angel. It's the absence of arrogance. Sometimes people project themselves as tzaddikim like that. Who says that he's such a bad man? Who says that one to suspect everybody? I'm a tzaddik, I don't suspect people. You're a rosha, that's what you are. You're an arrogant rosha. That means you don't believe that you yourself can do something dishonest. That means you don't believe that you yourself sometimes are attracted by expedience. Who do you think you are? Is that the other narishim? Before the chet? If you know yourself, you know other people too. And if you know how hard it is to keep yourself straight, if you know how hard it is to constantly keep on the alert, not to allow yourself to follow expedience, not to allow yourself to do that which is pleasant when it's wrong, not to allow yourself to do that which is convenient when it's not correct, and if you know the hardship that you undergo to stay that way, how can you not keep your eyes open for other people to keep yourself going straight? And you don't relax and think, well, everybody else also knows how to drive. You watch out like anything. If you know the alcoholic rate in South Africa, and you know how hard it is to drive straight when you've been drinking, you keep your eyes open for every other car. No such business. He knows that there's a white line there. What's he going to cross the white line? That naivety means you don't know yourself. Never mind that you don't know anybody else. One has to watch. One has to keep one's eyes open all the time for somebody who isn't able to withstand the temptations of expediency. And tznius is the test. When a man says, I do have human failings, and I like to cover them up, I'm embarrassed by them, that's all. Just feel embarrassed about it. Then one knows that the person is sensitive to his own weaknesses, and is sensitive also to other people's weaknesses. And he's the person that one can trust. One can trust his judgment, and one can trust his judgment of others. Where does the area of tznius come? We've said in all bodily areas. We cover as much of the body as we can. We had in the Gemara recently, one doesn't daven before the Yomid in short trousers, barefoot, one doesn't wear one shirt open to the belly button. We don't dress like that. Why not? Where's the issue? Tznius. That's the acknowledgement of the fact that our bodies are our weaknesses. A man who goes to the gym every day, twice a day, and he wears his sleeves up to here so that you should see, or he wears a vest. That's the latest. He has a vest. Some stupid statement on the front and on the back. So you should see his big muscles. What's the big thing? The big he wants to show how strong he is, how big he is. So he takes his weakest point and shows how big he is in his weakest point. The body. That's the point we're embarrassed about, because we know how weak it is. We know that when there becomes a conflict between the body and the mind, how hard it is to get the mind to win. So what do? We cover the body a little bit. We don't like to show it off. We're embarrassed by it. Not because the body is bad, it's a brilliant revenge, we're very proud of it. But we're embarrassed by its power. We're embarrassed by the fact that it has the power even to affect our thinking. And so we cover it as much as we can. And all physical things which have within them the ability to lead us towards expedience, we cover to constantly remind ourselves to keep that in its correct place. Not to allow that to become the dominant. Not to allow that to become the big thing. When in a country sports becomes the ultimate, you must know there's deterioration, you must know there's degeneration. When sports becomes everything, physical dominance, physical power, then you know that the country's on the downhill. Can't survive that kind of thing morally. Rambam Paskins, Shachochum Oichel Miad Ze Haroyiloi. When a Chochum eats the little bit which he's supposed to eat, because a Chochum is supposed to eat that which is healthy, and as much as which is healthy, not because it's nice, he eats because he needs it. Lo yechlenu elo beveisa al shulchanu. We should eat at home at his table. The lo yechal bechanus, you don't eat at the falafel shop. The lo beshuk, and you don't eat in Rehov Yafo. Elo mipnei tzorech godol, unless there's a great need for it. You have to, you're terribly hungry, that's the only place you can get some food. Kedei shelo yizgane bifnei abriyus, it shouldn't look ugly to people. Sneers, it doesn't look physical. That's the area where most people do it because they like it. Why do most people eat? Because it's nice. So you see a Talmid Chochem eating. You don't think he's eating because he's worked out that this is what I've got to do for my Avodas Hashem. You assume that he's eating for the same reason that you're eating. It's nice. It's not good to see. So it's that you hide. Eating is a normal bodily function. Yes, it is a normal bodily function. But it creates the wrong impression. Because people see it as part of the bodily function in terms of expedience rather than good and bad and right and wrong. Do it at home. You have to eat. You eat at home. And you don't eat by Amaratim because they're the most likely to misunderstand. and not by those tables which are full of disgusting things, where the conversation around the table is disgusting. And he shouldn't have lots of meals all over the place, even with chachomim. And he shouldn't eat in big gatherings of people. He should only eat at the suudas mitzvah. Only time he should eat out of the house. We're not going to get into a detailed understanding of this Rambam. It's just interesting to see the Rambam doesn't mention once that he has to check out from what butcher the meat is bought. Obviously the food has to be kosher, that goes without saying. It has to be properly kosher, but the Rambam is worried more about the mere fact of eating out. The mere fact of eating in public. It's the lack of tznius. Says Rashi, until there was a Yetzer Hara, there was no tznius. Tznius is the expression of the understanding of the havchana, the discernment, ein tov l'ra, that there is such a thing as being attracted to that which is pleasant and being unattracted by that which is unpleasant. And the acknowledgement of that is the first step that one can achieve towards overcoming that. The acknowledgement of that is in the area of tznius. This is also terribly important for our unmarried young men and women. But in the area of shiduchim also, in the society in which we operate, what does one go for? One goes for the attractive and one keeps away from the unattractive. Who says that's the best shidduch? Who says that's taka good? Nobody says it's good. In fact, it's likely to be exactly the opposite sometimes. Certainly one can't marry a person one finds unattractive. In fact, nobody would expect such a thing. But once the person is not unattractive, attractiveness becomes the least important factor. How attractive? That's the least important factor. Now one has to examine more important elements of the tovara. Of the real good and bad, not the apparent good and bad. And the society in which we live is a society without tznius. So on what does it operate? So women wear the kind of clothing which makes men attracted to them. Attracted to their midas? No. Attracted to their yichus? No. Attracted to their yirushamayim? No. Attracted to what? Their bodies. That's all. Because they know that since the time of the Chet of Adam HaRishon, that's how people are. People like what is pleasant and attractive. Yes, and that's where one has to be terribly careful. Tznius is the area where you show an understanding that that's not the important thing. A man who chooses a woman who is tznua, a woman who has tznius, shows that he understands this problem, that he understands this aspect. He knows that he's got to look deeper than just apparent attractiveness. Again, I say, nobody's expected to marry somebody they find unattractive. And Baruch Hashem, tastes are different, and all sorts of people find different things attractive and unattractive. And so every man and every woman, there's somebody that the Ribbono Shel Olam has set aside for them. But once that has been overcome, once there's no question of finding somebody repulsive, then the attractiveness goes by the board. That's no longer important. After that, it's the midas. After that, it's the tznius. After that, it's the greatness of the person herself or himself, not the apparent attractiveness. So we see that the consequence of the chet of Adam HaRishon is a consequence that we live with every day of our lives. It constitutes the very essence of a Torah life, overcoming this on a constant basis, expediency versus right and wrong. We dare not trust ourselves for a moment. And certainly we dare not trust other people for a moment in this area. We need to keep our eyes open. And only when we understand clearly can we act. And we see that it was from Adam HaRishon and Chava's very greatness, from their purity of spirit and from their greatness of mind, that they were naive and they had to be naive. And therefore when the Nachash comes along with statements which are emes, statements which are true, except they are politically motivated, Adam and Chava Nevech are unable to perceive the political motivation, and for that they are held responsible, and for that they are punished.